This week, we take a look at graduation requirements. Some say states have thrown them out. Others say that they have simply changed them for various reasons. Is this a good thing? Have they thrown the baby out with the bathwater? Or are we starting to figure things out and move ourselves in the right direction? We'll talk about these things and a lot more. So stay on board. Here we go.
This is the Educational Triage Podcast. Welcome. We invite you to come along with us on an exploration of interviews, issues, and other exciting and relevant topics in education, especially alternative education. They say alternative education is a laboratory for mainstream education. Why? Well, join us every week and listen in as Philip Summers,
aloha,
and I, Tony Hunt, jump in feet first to discuss issues that may affect our classes, students, communities, as well as our teaching. Please subscribe if you enjoy and find relevance in what you experience here. And if you haven't left a quick review, please do. We appreciate your candor and insights so we can improve as we move forward. Now, let's see what's on board today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Educational Triage Podcast. I am here with the incredible, effervescent, invigorating, wonderfully thinking constantly, Philip Summers. Hey, Philip.
Aloha. I feel like I'm over-promising and under-delivering.
I did the promising. You got to deliver.
I better be very effervescent today.
I think so. Now that we have, and just for our viewers, we do record weeks in advance, but we have the Northern Lights going on with the huge solar show that's happening. So maybe that will electrify our thinking today. You think?
Possibly. There's a lot of, radio waves and solar flares running through the atmosphere. So,
yeah, exactly. So, okay. So graduation requirements, I remember sitting in the classroom and getting word that they had just tossed out the graduation requirements here in the state of Oregon, and people were cheering. And I asked them why they were cheering, and they said, well, it was an equity issue because it wasn't fair that we should require all students to be able to read and write at a certain level because certain minorities did not have access and were not able to do that. And I thought, wow, you really did bring your racism out to the forefront, didn't you?
There's a lead in.
Well, there we go. I mean, because
you brought your racism to the front. It's true. What was it? What's the phrase?
Soft racism.
Soft racism.
The racism of soft expectations, yeah, I think, is...
I think that's true.
How Rosemary Allen described it when we had her
on.
I
couldn't quote her. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was right about that. The standards. Although there is an issue, there's some truth to that. You know, there were some lack of resources and lacks of paths to get to those standards on behalf of some kids, most of which were... They weren't primary English speakers, like Russians. Right. There's an awful lot of Russian kids. They could speak in Russian like nobody's business, but to tackle English was difficult for them. And a lot of Spanish speaking people like that. Yeah.
Well, if you're going to get into immersion, my understanding from talking even with Lexi Bouchert, who we had on the show. Huh? It takes over 6 years for a student to gain academic language and understanding in a new language.
Yeah. And that's if they're working at it, and trying
to. Right, right. And next week we're going to be talking about the falling math and reading scores and what's around that. And we can't attribute that to ESL because we're looking at regular language learners. But
yeah.
I believe that there are some standards that are there that take into account whether or not a student is an ELL and what they can do, because yes, it's not fair for, and it's not equitable for a student to come in their freshman year from another country and then expect them to be able to profit from the education that they're having while also negotiating a brand new territory of living and possibly an economic whatever it is for them in order to survive. So they're dealing with moving, they're dealing with survival, they're dealing with brand new environments, and to throw that up on top of them is absolutely unfair.
It's a different society than it was, say, 1910 as opposed to 2010, for sure.
But the culture shock is real. I've lived it. Other people have lived it. So
I think what we have to clarify is, what are we talking about when we're talking about lowering graduation standards? And so for years, it ran on credits. Everyone's been through the 4 years of English that's been required everywhere at all times. I don't know why, but English teachers got job security. And then, you know, you've got like 2 years or 3 years of social studies, and you got PE and health and then electives. And those are the classes you're supposed to pass those and get your grades, and then your grade point average averages out in the simple days. And then what happened was when George Bush became president, they started to get into education. And so a way to measure people and see if they're qualified to achieve a high school diploma status would be to test in reading and writing and basic mathematics, or, you know, even some.
It was to use some form of measurement. Now,
in
Oregon,
on a standard.
Right. Now, they do that in Oregon. I don't know about other states. And I know that they do the Regents test in New York. Yeah. And there were other tests in other states. But if a student didn't pass that, then they created work samples. And we worked on
those.
There
was that, too. There was a way around that. Yeah,
right. So it's not like it was set in stone and that it was immovable. You could move it.
And to be honest, I liked it because I felt like, okay, if you're going to tell me that's the minimum capability that one of my students needs going out in the world, I'm going to nail that. I want them to have that. And I would look at their writing and go, look, you really need to hone it this way. You need to get this out of the reading, because it was important. And I thought it was a pretty decent scaled standards test. So I went after it. I made sure that all my students just nailed it. I kind of taught the test, but I didn't. Yeah.
And to be quite honest, I've known people from Emory University who are working on their masters who could not write a single paragraph and use punctuation. They had no idea what punctuation was. And these were people in linguistics and in English.
What?
Yeah. So,
No. No. I mean, come on. There's leniency, but if I can achieve the skill, maybe I'm arrogant by saying that, but if I can do it, most people can probably do it. I mean, I'm not a Hemingway, but then again, you know, I can write. You can understand what I'm trying to tell you in written form.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like reading Latin when Latin was first in writing, because there is no punctuation and you have to figure out how to divvy up the words so that you understand what it is that you're reading. Here's one, at the old Latin.
A lot of people are using, I'm using a lot of humbleness, you know, in my life. And I go, you mean humility? It's like, it's not humbleness. The state of being humble is exercising humility.
But see,
it's not humbleness. You can put N-E-S-S at the end of any noun and all of a sudden it becomes
converseness.
Your adjective, yeah.
Jokefulness.
What? No. Humbleness.
But what worked, I think, was the fact that there was wiggle room for the students, and there was time and energy that you could spend working with the student and making it into a teachable moment, you know? Yeah. And the students would learn from that. And it was a good safety net for those students. Because once you taught them that, then you could see where they could go. But then you also worked with the ELL teachers and you figured out, okay, what do we need to do in order to get this student to a place where they could succeed? Because you don't just want to spit them out with a high school diploma and no skills and make them tread water, because now they're going from maybe class one rapids and you've tossed them into class three and you're saying, swim it, baby, swim it. You can do it.
Use your paddles.
Yeah. Those water wings will help.
Why didn't I think of that?
So, and then we got Race to the Top, which was simply the same thing as what Bush had. And we still have even more demands put on everything. And that was Obama. So it's like all these strictures were put in there. Now, we have to remember, a student cannot become a senior without senior credits. They may have been socially promoted all the way through, but they cannot be deemed a senior if they don't have those credits.
Good point. Yeah.
So if you don't have those credits and you're graduating, there's something wrong in your system already. So you needed to have been able to pass it. You need to be in an alternative structure where you can work and you can learn. I mean, you've worked with students who are at very low levels, I'm sure, when they came into your programs.
Yeah.
And then you had to work with them very diligently and work with them. But you also had a household, because I'm thinking about the program that was residential that you worked in, where you had structures where they were supported with that. But a lot of our students, they don't have those supports. So it's whatever the devil's going to give you. And then you have to work with that. But that doesn't mean you're always going to be successful. And you can't just let a kid squeak by because you feel sorry for them. You need to be kind of an a-hole and force them into getting there. Because if you're the coach on a team, you can't let somebody on there who has no clue what they're doing go out there and run or participate. That's why you have drills. That's why you work and you practice and you practice and you practice.
Yeah, I that's the go-to that I had with students is, you know, when I was going through all these things about, oh, we got to get these credits, we got to do this work, da, da, da. And it's like, it's an is. It's not like, you know, it just is the way it is. And that, you know, and there's a lot of life that is like that. And this is that. When you graduate high school, you should be able to function at a basic level. Yeah.
Right. And so I know that in certain states that I was able to pull up some things on different states and how they changed everything from what it was. And at-risk populations, which is what we really want to talk about, I think, with this, because if anybody's going to suffer from all these changes, it could be them, but also, are they going to be able to benefit from these changes?
Well, yeah, in the end, that's why we're trying to educate people, is for a certain purpose. So are we testing for that purpose?
Yeah, well, let's take a look at why, well, the potential concerns and criticisms associated with removing the graduation requirements. Can I throw these out there?
Yeah, go.
Really quickly? Okay. So The first one is lowered expectations. And I think we addressed that at the very beginning. That expectations and standards would harm students' preparedness for post-graduation. Tracking and labeling and just doing that with students and not allowing them to actually shine, because we don't know what a student's learning maturation rate is, because a student may be able to work with other students and then pop out. And so I do have to give credit in some districts where they put all students into, they have heterogeneous populations in the highly rigorous classes like IB or AP,
right,
where they're going to be able to get something. Now, granted, sometimes those aren't always going to work out well, and so you need to figure out how you're going to support those students and scaffold them up. And then there's also the problem with resource allocation. How, if you're going to be changing everything, how are you going to change the resources, and how are you going to make those better as and have those in place? Because you darn well better know what it is that you're putting in place and what the results are going to be, which is a huge issue, considering that we have so many policymakers who are in the, I'm going to call it the educational laboratory at the state and and different levels, who are championing these things, who don't have the foggiest clue what they're talking about, and yet they expect everybody to be able to run out and do everything at the snap of a finger.
Yeah, a lot of it was tied to money.
Yeah. So we have what the initiatives to replace the graduation requirements that aim to ensure equity, flexibility, quality assurance, and rigor would be California's local control funding formula and local control and accountability plan, Oregon's graduation pathways initiative, Kentucky's non-traditional instruction program, New Hampshire's performance assessment for competency education, PACE. And I have to give it, and I know that New York has a completely different system that they're trying to implement, which is very much what Oregon was trying to implement back in the 90s. And the same people who are championing what it is that they're going to be putting in now, in place now, are the very same people who didn't like it back then. They've done a complete about face. So it means portfolios and work samples. It means demonstration of skills and abilities, et cetera.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So, and the reason why they didn't like it before was because there was a lot of paperwork and you had to hold on to things at the same time. And so just the ability to be able to hold all these work samples and the, and grade all these and put all those through. Now, perhaps this time round, they've learned their lesson, and so it's not going to be quite as extreme as what we had back then. I don't know.
Yeah, they tied it to funding, and then they started to record things, and everyone was like, they hired whole positions like within. I know that in the district we worked in, there was one overall testing coordinator, and then each building, I think, had one or two testing coordinators, and their job was to maintain security for the test, maintain the schedule of the test, the integrity, the, report it, calc the numbers, all that good stuff.
Right. Right. Let's take a look at California really quickly if we can. Are you cool with that? Okay. Their LCFF, Local Control Funding Formula, provides additional funding to school districts with higher numbers of English language learners. Low-income students and foster youth. And then the local control and accountability plan requires districts to engage stakeholders, including parents and community members, in developing plans to address local priorities And that has to do with outcomes for disadvantaged students.
Oh, yeah.
So this way, districts can allocate resources based on specific needs, promote equity and flexibility while ensuring that there is accountability for the student outcomes. So students aren't getting away scot-free. They still have to be able to perform things, but it gives them a way to do it.
Yeah.
With other supports, but you can't always count on the community. Sure, there's going to be a lot of people in the community who will support you. In Oregon, their Graduation Pathways Initiative provides multiple pathways to graduation. It allows students to demonstrate proficiency through coursework, exams, projects, and other assessments. Offers flexibilities for students to pursue their interests and strengths while maintaining rigorous academic standards. They also provide targeted support and interventions for students who may face barriers to graduation, such as English language learners, students with disabilities, and they promote equity and ensure that all students have the right to succeed. Kentucky's NTI, non-traditional instruction, districts can provide instruction through non-traditional means such as online courses, independent study, or project-based learning. Flexibility allows districts to tailor their instruction to meet the diverse needs of students, including those who may face barriers to traditional schooling, such as transportation, childcare issues. And then districts need to monitor student progress and outcomes rigorously, ensuring that students receive a high-quality education regardless of the instructional format. So this will put more focus on the districts and what they're doing in order to implement everything. That's my understanding. New Hampshire's PACE program, Performance Assessment for Competency Education.
Very cute.
This allows districts to use performance assessments such as projects, presentations, portfolios to measure student proficiency instead of standardized tests.
Right.
The approach promotes deeper learning and critical thinking skills while providing flexibility for students to demonstrate their knowledge and skills in authentic contexts. New Hampshire also provides training and support for educators to develop and implement high-quality performance assessments, ensuring rigor and consistency across the state.
Right, yeah.
But you're always going to get those outliers who are just going to let people skate, right? Because one, they're lazy. Two, they think that the whole thing is a crock. And they don't see any real reason for it. But it comes down to whether or not they really care about what's going to happen with the kids and the fact that they may just be lazy.
I noticed that there's all of these things you speak of. One of the basic things they have is, you know, the different pathways for graduation performance assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And we spoke about that a lot. You know, there's got to be more than just one way to show your proficiency at something.
Right. Because tests, tests can only measure things in a certain manner.
Yeah.
They test and, what they're looking for. Right. Because it's very expensive to hire scorers on tests when they have to read the writings of students.
Yeah.
And even that can be biased because you see messy handwriting and you think, ah, crikey, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
You know? And so you go through it, and unless it's absolutely brilliant, you're thinking, well, whatever, because you yourself have a challenge learning how to read that.
Challenge reading it, yeah. It's true, yeah.
So,
Go ahead.
No, you go.
I was just thinking, that makes total sense. If some of these graduation requirements are going away for multiple pathways to graduation, I'm in favor of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are talking about, well, if he's a test, how do we know the standards are being met? But then I recall when these were first imposed, I didn't have a problem with the standard that it presented. I had a problem with the fact that I thought we'd be teaching to the test.
Right.
And everyone said, oh, that won't happen. And I said, yeah, sure. I mean, because that's the object. That's the object. That's my target, to get these kids to take this test and pass it. So of course I'm going to teach to the test. That's the objective. I'm going to go around it in all kinds of different ways, but that is definitely going to be like the North Star if you make it that for graduation.
However, I've always had a different viewpoint, and that was, well, first of all, I don't know what's on the test.
Yeah.
But what I want students to be able to do is to be prepared so that they can look at a problem and they can find multiple pathways to solve that problem. So with mathematics, how do you solve a problem? What is it you know? What do you need to find out? How do you take information? It's the same thing with critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with just reading something. What do you know? What do you bring to the reading? And what are you learning? What do you think that they're going to try to extract from you in that reading? And once you're able to do that, and you're able to have critical conversations, and you start teaching and treating your students, perhaps not as peers, but as intelligent, sentient beings that might actually, which can be difficult with freshmen, I agree.
It's true. Middle school.
I think that I still remember that one kid in seventh grade when I was teaching. He looked at me and he said, Why are you trying to treat us like we're adults? We're just children. We're just young. And I said, well, the day is approaching that's going to change. And then you're going to say, quit treating me like a baby.
Yeah. Don't treat me like a child.
Yeah. But that was partly because I don't think they wanted to have that accountability. But we're seeing people not understanding or having a lack of accountability from the home all the way through every single day. I mean, it's absolutely astounding,
right,
the lack of awareness that people have as far as what their part in life is, or even in a regular situation. And I'm not going to go any further than that, because then we go down another rabbit hole.
Well,
but
that's a good segue. I was just thinking, what are we testing for? I mean, we got this test, we got that, we got this class, but what is the outcome we're after? And I think we're in a wilderness right now as a society. I don't think we know what to test for. We used to know what to test for, because you had to carry around that working knowledge and be, you know, proficient and fluent with your language, and your mathematics had to be basic enough to do your fundamental budgets and your calculations. And you had to be able to do that from a knowledge base. You couldn't look that up and learn it and then come back and do the task. Now I go to YouTube if I want to fix something. it's like knowledge is everywhere. So
you've got the tutorials that are right there.
Right. You know, I don't know what to do with all this information. And so now what should we test for? What should schools actually do instead of
we need just to teach students,
graduates?
Well, we need to do the basic skills, and those are reading, writing, and arithmetic.
The communication skills and math is a language. Let's not.
It is.
I grew up thinking there's a language and then there's math. It's like, no, it's a language.
It's actually a thinking logic skill.
Yeah, it's very much its own thing, but
which is why I didn't do well with it. At least I didn't.
I never did well with it either. But I would have, if I had the context down, I would have done better, because I would understand what I was trying to do all the time.
Well, somebody told me that I needed to teach proofs, and I said, then somebody else has to do it, because I still can't do them. There's something about doing proofs in geometry that throw me completely onto the other side. I might as well just dig straight down through to China, so to speak, and pop out there and try to teach them their own language. It's not going to work. It's just not going to happen.
You don't know Cantonese?
No. Or Mandarin.
God, could you imagine? I mean, I look at that that character language, you know, and I don't mm-hmm. know what those characters mean. That is a totally alien bunch of marks to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different language for sure.
That's what proofs are to me.
That's it. Yeah, that math's always been that way to me. And I'd go through it fundamentally, but then I couldn't understand mm-hmm. why. At the end of it, I go, well, I did it, but I still don't know why I did that way.
But if we can teach students to get to a point, because different minds think differently.
That's it. And yeah.
And but they should all be able to, okay, I know that A squared plus B squared equals C squared. I know those formulas. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's for a triangle. So if I can memorize those things, because when I had to do the CBEST to get into teacher training in Oregon, even though I'd passed it in California, I hired a tutor to help me with the math because I was terrified. Yeah. Even though I'd passed it before. And it all came right back to me, except for the proofs. And those weren't there. And I was so grateful. I was so grateful. But it's sequential. It's almost a syllogism is what proofs are.
Right.
And so you learn that whole way of thinking. My brothers all tried to teach me. My father tried to teach me. And they just kind of, I think they threw their hands up and walked away because I was totally useless.
Maybe in that particular topic you are.
I am. I'm completely, yeah. I can think logically, I can do syllogisms, but not proofs.
You know, it's something that's occurred to me as I've been teaching is it's kind of absurd to walk into a classroom of, say, 28 high school mm-hmm. kids and assume that we're all going to learn the same thing at the same time in the same hour on the same day.
Right. And there are a lot of teachers who are fighting back and they are saying, we cannot do this. We can't do differentiated learning. It's a crock because then we have too many things. If you are a skilled teacher, if you are a good teacher, it's part of your bag of tricks. I tell kids, okay, this is what we're going to be doing. Now, here are some ways that you can look at it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And then I throw that out there. And if it's not working for one kid, well, let's try it this way. Let's try it that way. And, you know, sometimes they surprise you and they come up with another way of looking at things that you hadn't before and they get it right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we shouldn't be, I think too often teachers think that they are the experts and they're not. They're simply the conduit of information.
Yeah, they're guides.
Yeah, and schools house those conduits where it's like the piping.
Yeah. It just comes to me that to even set up a structure where you're teaching the same thing at the same time to all these same kids, and mm-hmm. it just doesn't seem natural. There seems like, let's talk about the concept of a metaphor. It's a very important concept. But do you remember the moment you went, oh, that's what a metaphor is? No.
Yes.
You collected information. You collected images. You liked movies. You saw things that had metaphors that really touched you. And over the years, you realized, oh, that's a metaphor.
We were taught explicitly what a metaphor and a simile were.
No. Well, similes, A, or as and like, but other than that, I was never taught specifically. I didn't understand conceptually until I understood.
Oh, they drummed it into our heads.
A metaphor for me was still a cloudy institution, even though I adored them. So, yeah.
And that's true for even postgraduate students.
Yeah.
Because when I've taught workshops at the university and we're discussing similes and metaphors, they're not getting it. And all of a sudden, you know, partway through the lesson, all of a sudden, boop, the epiphany is there. And they get it.
You can see that epiphany.
Right.
Most learning is done sort of like, I heard this phrase, become enlightened, then do the dishes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like that. You know, as you learn things, you go, oh, eureka. I got to go do the dishes because it doesn't last. And you go, oh, now I'm at level 18 of humanity. Now you don't get a gold star. Things are easier. Get carried from room to room now. No,
yes.
It's like, yeah, great. Revelation. Now do the dishes.
Well, it's kind of like when I was in high school. I think I was a sophomore. Yeah. And I was thinking about the presidential races. And I was walking down the hallway and all of a sudden it hit me. And I'm like, oh. Because in my head, as a little kid, yeah, whenever they talked about a presidential race, I saw the candidates in there. In their jerseys and in shorts, running a track.
You picture Ronald Reagan running in shorts?
Oh, no, I figured it out before he ran.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
I was thinking more along Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon.
Oh, I was going to say, it's like Johnson, Nixon, and Humphrey.
And I was thinking, and I think this might have been during the McGovern race, and I'm thinking, no. That doesn't make sense. And all of a sudden it just clicked on me because conceptually I understood what a presidential race was.
Right.
But it hadn't really infiltrated my core thinking process.
Exactly.
And so
you didn't have the context to put it in.
Well, I had this image in my head. I had this image in my head and it was predominant.
Yeah,
it was that dominant issue.
Well, the word race.
Yes.
I know what a race is. You said it's a race. I can picture a race. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah. But, you know, when you're a teenager, your brain isn't completely gelled. It's going through a second evolution in a sense.
And it's also got this mechanism in it that says, no, you're the smartest human on the planet.
You are the most immortal human on the planet as well.
It's just like, yeah, that too. You cannot be killed.
Now, earlier, before we started recording tonight, you asked a really, really fantastic question.
Which was?
Are we on the right track in what we're testing for? Do we even know what we're testing for? Yeah. Do we understand that we're not really using technology the way that technology should be used? Right. Something along those lines. And it, you know, and I've been like mulling that over in my head, but I'd like you to go further with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I made the comment too. I think we've perfected education for the 1950s.
That's it. Yeah.
I think we got it nailed. If it was only 1955 again, damn it, we would just rock.
Or even the 60s, because I think J.D. Hirsch wrote the book Cultural Literacy.
Yeah, okay.
And I thought that was a very important book at its time. And it all made sense, everything that he said. And the question then is, has cultural literacy really changed and evolved that much today, or does it change hourly because we have all the TikTok, we have all the social media, we have so many things, and yet there are still the bases, the foundational things that people need to know so that we are working together in a country that is full of diversity, diverse cultures, everything. What holds us together? That's what cultural literacy talked about.
Right.
The fact that everybody has the same basic foundational understanding and precepts that they can work from.
Right.
So
try this. Well, here's an example. So we're going through language and, I hate to raise this image up, but once upon a time in America, you know, some people would say, this is America. We speak English in America. And there was even a movement to make English the American language, you know, the official American language, which is absurd because oh my God, we're a nation of immigrants. So what? Anyway, so if you think about that, you're speaking English. It's 250 years ago. There's no other language that you really know of if you're an ordinary person. And if you saw a person of Asian descent, it's like, good God, that woman's eyes are like totally different than mine. It would be like a mind blow.
Right.
And so now you've got humans of every kind, you know, of every color and, you know, configuration, mm-hmm. and sexual orientation. And we've really learned to accept ourselves as this kind of nondescript, vibrant being. You know, humans aren't just one thing. There are many things. And so how are we still using the same education system that would exclude anything that was foreign, quote, in a world which is just overflowing with foreign information? Everything we get, it's new, it's different. We consider points of view that we never even knew existed.
Let me quickly tag on that.
Help me.
I think people, maybe it's because we have such an influx of information thrown at us, yeah. that people aren't accepting of other points of view.
I would say that's a good.
They become far more intolerant, and maybe yeah. that has to do with the 24-hour news cycle. Maybe it has yeah. to do with the barrage of information, that there's only so much that we can take.
Right.
But go ahead, keep going. I didn't want to stop your flow.
You reach everybody, and you know, if you're a good prejudiced person, you know who the good people are and the bad people are, and they're identifiable. Mm-hmm. And everyone yeah. knows that those people over there, they do this, and we don't. You know, we're not like them. They and them, and mm-hmm. and so. If you prejudge everybody, yeah, they fit into your nice little tableau there, your play, per se, you're the director. But everyone's rejecting that yoke. They're saying, no, you can't just prejudge me based upon my height, nationality, weight, eye color, whatever it is you're going to do. I am who I am, and here I am. And so it probably just short circuits a lot of central circuits in the brain, like, what? I can't classify you. Well, then how do I know if you're dangerous or if you're friendly? And it's like, well, it's a skill. You can't just judge me right off and then approach me from that angle.
But they do. And
yeah.
And this whole notion that if you're black, then you are this. If you're yeah. white, then you are automatically this.
Yes.
If you are Asian, you are automatically this. If you're Native American, you are automatically that.
It gets even worse. If you're light-skinned black, you're automatically this. Dark-skinned black.
Yes.
If you're male white, you're this. Male white female, you're this. If you're a younger white female, you're that. It's like, oh my God, see?
And unfortunately, that is because the brain stops working around age 8 or 9 or 10. Before it goes through its next evolution, they can't get out of that. It's almost as though they have, I don't know, it's almost like the brain of an addict where they cling on to preconceived notions and they can't let them go because it's a safety net for them.
Is that true about 8?
I read that sometime between 8 and 11, that those are the years that everything is, because they can't get into the critical thinking. Critical thinking yeah. doesn't exist. And so that's why we have the new Puritans that are coming out, the ones that are telling everybody what they need to be doing. I was discussing this because years ago when I lived in Berkeley, somebody said, what's it like living in Berkeley? And I said, these people are so liberal that they are ultra conservative. And I was telling somebody that the other day, and they said, yes. I said, they are just as it's like they've come full circle, and they are just about to kiss the butts of the far right.
Yeah, they're just close enough together they can almost touch.
And it's yes, yes. And you sit there and you think their lack of awareness on this is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they are so conservative. They are so, I don't know, because they have a lack. No, they have such an intolerance for certain things. Right. And, you know, you hear these people and they say, well, we're against hate. While they become violent and they throw things and try to destroy people.
Right. I'm against war and violence. So we're going to set this thing on fire.
And we don't care who we hurt. So it's like this hypocrisy that they just don't understand. So my question is, and I think you're right, we are teaching in the 50s for a group of people who have devolved in many ways because we rely on technology to do so much for us. I have a stove that when I put a timer on a unit, it shuts the unit off when the timer goes off, and then it will shut the entire stove off.
You can't even burn your own damned house down anymore.
Darn it. But things have become easier, but that doesn't mean that we stop thinking. But think about how long you spend on social media. Think about how addictive just going through Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, X, any of those.
I have, and I don't go through any of them. I have none of them, no apps on my phone like that. I just don't. I used to, and now it's like, what is the purpose of doing this? It just doesn't matter.
Yeah. And so it makes you wonder, because they don't do anything to help the brain.
No. People adapt to it. I was actually told by a past supervisor that you have to understand that lessons today, you can't show like a whole movie, for example, because the kids can't sit still for it. You have to show it in like 15, 30 minute increments and break it down. That's about all they can handle, if that. And I'm thinking, you're right. TikTok's like how many seconds? It's frenetic. It's like Riverdance I remember when they showed Riverdance, it was so frenetic. And then so I'm a dancer and I'm going, okay, how is this guy doing it? And every time they'd show his feet, they cut away in 2 seconds. And I started to notice every camera cut was like at 2 seconds. And I went, no wonder people like this. This is just like a roller coaster ride.
But you know what? This is what people were fed. Do you know what innovation started this shortened attention span?
Oh, God, what?
MTV.
That's right. You're right. MTV.
MTV, because it held your attention for 2 to 3 seconds because of the music videos.
Yeah.
Constant flashes of information or images, whatever.
Yeah. Really snazzy interludes, breaks to commercial.
Yeah.
Really, sensational kind of stuff.
Right. You're right. And so social media basically does the same thing.
Yeah. I was looking through the YouTube. YouTube has a little strip of quickie, I don't know, shorts, I think they call them. Mm-hmm. They're like 20 seconds long and it's like, tell me more. And then it's over. And I'm like, no, you can't just lay that on me and go, see ya. It's like, no, I need more. Give me more.
Yeah. Well, somebody was watching. I went zip lining up in Alaska.
Yeah.
The other day, and it's touted as the longest zip line.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to get through, and you're up to 60 miles an hour, and it's a rush. It is so great.
I bet.
And I did the editing on a friend's video, and because she was able to, I had my GoPro on, and they said, dude, you're going to lose your GoPro. And I said, what if I put my hands on my head? They said, dude, you probably aren't going to want to put your hands on your head. And I said, okay. So I took it off, which I'm not thrilled with. But she had a great video. And she's like, oh, no. Oh, no. Anyway, she goes down. And I was showing it to somebody today. And it's only a minute and a half. But this woman who was looking at it today looked at me and said, this is so long. And it hadn't even been a minute yet. She goes, this is one of the longest videos I have seen on ziplining. And I thought, yeah, because usually it's just a quick zip for like maybe less than 30 seconds.
Yeah, a frenetic 15 seconds. Yeah.
So, and I thought, wow, that's really interesting that you think that, because I'm looking at all the scenery around her and how and how high a drop off it would be if a body were to fall.
It's a great view.
It is. It's a fantastic view. And anyway, so afterwards she said, wow, that was one long trip down. And I said, yeah. And she goes, yeah, maybe you could speed it up a little bit. And I thought,
Wow.
That's I found that really interesting, because people want things quick. Because even in the news cycle, news stories, I mean, sometimes they go on, but what's that?
I said news stories.
Oh, yeah, news stories. They're quick.
And they're just superficial. And when they have breaking news, they don't care if they got the facts right. They just want to be first. And so they come up with, like, for example, Columbine. Remember, they were supposed to be some sort of trench coat mafia. False. Targeting jocks and social, you know, girls. False. There's another one, you know, and it's like they first broke that news and it turned out that that stuff was not even close to true.
However, that began clickbait.
And those guys actually got
that was in the early days. If I can tell you something that might be, you're going to click on this because you're going to want to hear it, whether it's regardless if it's true or not.
Well, give the people what they want, whether they need it or not, I guess.
Yeah, but the problem is, and I was hearing this, I was hearing all this misinformation that people have on different subjects on my last tour, and I just sat there just listening, and I was amazed at what people actually believe. And I'm thinking, where the heck did you get that information? That is bizarre. Because if you listen to what they say and you cogitate for a minute or two and you realize that doesn't make any sense.
Right. It doesn't make any sense.
And most people would think that those were the ramblings of a mad person. But these people are sane, but they believe it.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know what to call it, but it's the job of the schools to help people think. And these other people, they have diverse thinking. God love them.
I was thinking, you know, here we are opening up Pandora's box of maybe our school system's completely antiquated and out of date, needs to be completely rehauled. Without saying, I'll do it. I volunteer. I would be part of a committee to try to get that done, because I think we need to do it. It's like, but we're just not. It's just become a thing that is.
You can't replace it until you have a replacement that would be effective.
We keep on going with the same model. It's not working, I think. And
that's because
I wasn't against lowering the tests, you know, getting those tests out. I was never for them. I am for standards. I noticed graduation rates in the nation are like 85%. But I've also noticed that some schools are woefully below that, like somewhere around 52. And that's just like, how is there any school in existence that graduates on time 52% of the kids, unless they intentionally keep them an extra year, which may not be a bad idea. Future episode, maybe. I don't know.
But I think that that is something that will play into next week's episode.
Ah, there you go. Yeah.
Where we look at failing math, falling math, reading and writing scores.
Right.
So.
See, I knew that. Good segue.
And this is a great segue for us to say we're out of time.
Yes, we are.
But I think we hit on some really good points. And I think yours, I think what you leave us with is a brilliant one. How do we adapt education to reflect the times that we live in.
Right. It's clearly changed.
Yeah, it clearly has.
We all know.
And so has the population. So,
yep. Yeah.
So thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Tony.
And to all of our listeners, thank you. And stay tuned for next week's episode. And we will see you then. Until then, keep your feet on the ground while reaching for the stars. Bye-bye.
Aloha.